This episode of Moon Tower Business is brought to you by your local State Farm agent, Alejandra de la Torre. Alejandra's team has amazing customer service, knowledgeable staff, and super competitive pricing. They also have a very convenient location in Round Rock, located at 2200 North A.W. Grimes Boulevard, Suite 500. Alejandra's team is bilingual, and they have over 52 years of combined experience in the insurance industry. Alejandra's team is very friendly and helpful, and they always go the extra mile. They even have after-hours emergency availability. So please call Alejandra's State Farm team for all of your insurance needs, whether it's auto, home, life, or business. Their telephone number is 512-244-3311, or you can see their website at www.alexdelatorre.net. Welcome back, everyone, to another edition of the Moon Tower Business Podcast. This is your host, Joseph Obell. And today I have the pleasure of speaking to Peter Desberg and Jeffrey Davis, who are the authors of a book called Pitch Like Hollywood, What You Can Learn from the High-Stakes Film Industry. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. How are you all today?
Great. Pretty good considering.
Excellent. Well, before we kind of get into the book, I figured maybe we can start off by each of you introducing yourselves and kind of just talking a little bit about yourselves and things you've worked on in the past in your career. Maybe, Peter, you can start with you.
Oh, we always let Jeffrey start first.
Okay, Jeffrey.
Sure. Well, Joseph, I am third generation show business. Despite my father begging me to go into retail, which was the other side of the family, I followed him into the industry, started in situation comedy, a little bit of drama it was a long time ago. And then I'll tell you, I came back. So in the meantime, I worked in advertising for a long time, PR, did corporate shows, produced corporate shows, wrote them. And then in the mid-2000s, I came back to TV and was lucky enough to get a mentor. I've been very lucky. I've had Peter as a mentor. I've had many mentors. This mentor taught me how to produce. And so I feel like I kind of came full circle. And then the book happened. Peter suggested we write the first book together, not this book. This will be our third. And so that's kind of my story. Long time, grew up in the industry, so I got to know it really well.
Excellent. And what city are you located in?
I'm in Los Feliz, which is the eastern part of Los Angeles.
Great. Peter, how about you?
Well, I've spent a good part of my life as a boring university professor, which I guess is redundant. And trained as a research psychologist. And one of the areas that I enjoy doing research in was the psychology of humor. And that led to teaching a class called Instructional Humor, which was a class for public speakers on how to get their points across using humor. And made an interesting personal discovery that every class was fun and light until it came time for them to do stuff to show what they learned. And that's when I got convinced that the fear of public speaking really is the number one phobia in America. It's interesting that if you like statistics, that the fear of dying is number five.
Wow.
Jerry Seinfeld has a great way of saying it. He said, the next time that you're at a funeral, understand that most people would rather be in the coffin than doing the eulogy. And from there, I also went back and got a clinical license so that I could actually work with people. So I've been working with people that have performance anxiety and stage fright forever.
Including me. I'm one of his. It's true, because I did have, when I met Peter, I had been through years and years and years of terrible pitch panic, stage fright beforehand. And one of the reasons that I was so excited about this book is that a lot of books on the subject of pitching don't include stage fright or persuasion and the science behind them.
No doubt. I mean, I understand that firsthand. I've done several pitches. I think I told both you gentlemen I'm an attorney, but I've also worked with a startup company and had to pitch the company and the idea before a lot of people. And it's nerve-wracking. It's I think anyone can have stage fright, and it takes time to and strategy to kind of overcome that and figure out how to make a good pitch. And I think both of you have a kind of the best mix of backgrounds to write this book and to guide people on how to make a good pitch. So I've been reading the book and really enjoy it. And I'm definitely going to take lessons learned from that in my career and the things that I'm working on.
That's very kind. Thank you.
Very kind. Thank you. It's interesting when you said anybody can have it, that one of the questions we're asked a lot is, are there, some people don't seem nervous, other people, are there haves and have nots? And the data is really clear on everybody gets it. It's a question of when. It's totally situational.
Right.
We had I did an interview with a fellow who runs the LA Master Chorale. They're the people that sing with our Philharmonic Orchestra. He told me a story that he went to the Vatican and did a performance in St. Peter's Square in front of 5,000 people, the entire College of Cardinals and the Pope. That no nerves, nothing. It was just pure fun. A month later, he goes to Atlanta to do the American Choral Conductors Convention with the same choir doing the same program. He said his hand was shaking so much he could hardly hold on to the baton.
Wow.
But again, the Pope was never going to say, hey, you missed the downbeat on the 74th measure. But to those choral conductors, that was going to be a scandal.
Right, right. I've noticed in my career, when I'm speaking in front of a lot of people I don't know, I'm not really nervous. But when you're around people that you know really well, it's more and more nerve-wracking. It's been my experience.
It's interesting because some people get more nervous in front of small groups than large groups. And there's interesting evidence that if you walk into a room and all of a sudden you see somebody you know, or even a friend, that instead of helping you, giving you support, it can get you scared.
No doubt.
Yeah.
So you both have written a few other books together. Can you guys just touch a little bit on that and kind of what are the subjects of those books?
Sure.
Can I tell you how this came about? Because it's a story I really like.
Sure.
He's going to tell you this story, and I would believe about three quarters of it.
You're judging by the size of my nose, that's not fair. I met Jeffrey because he reluctantly came to my house to pick up his kid, who was having a play date with my kid. And neither of us enjoyed the meeting a new dad and what do you do and what do you do. But we found that we were both university profs. And I had told him a story about when I heard that he wrote comedy, that I had done a research study with somebody where we interviewed Hollywood comedy writers. And instead of saying, well, how'd you get interested in comedy? How do you know you're funny? That we actually gave him tasks to do and had them work. And Jeffrey said, who are the writers? And his eyes started getting as big as saucers. And he said, everybody you mentioned so far was around my crib playing poker with my dad. And literally like 15 or 20 minutes into the door, he jumped off the couch and said, let's do it. Let's write the book. And what we did, and this was a great contribution that Jeffrey made, instead of just what I had done was ask piecemeal questions, but he said, let's write a short comedy premise and give it to these people. You can't trust asking somebody what their process is like, that they understand it or know it. We have a phrase we like, the greatest form of fiction is the autobiography. and so what happened was we gave them this premise and said, develop it for us. And we got to watch the best writers in the business create on the spot.
Wow.
And it's like you're looking in somebody's ear, seeing their brain on creativity. And we're very proud of it because all we did was edit it. They did all the work.
Right.
That's very interesting. And when was that book released?
The last version of the book, which was
2007,
was it 2017, I think.
Yeah.
Great. And what kind of feedback did you get from that, from readers?
Well, Jeffrey loved it.
Actually, you know what, Joseph, it's been doing pretty well, and we're getting really good feedback. And I know, for example, that I give it to my students because it shows that I think one of the reasons I wanted to get involved in it is that you grow up around an industry where you're told there's all kinds of ways to do something. And then I don't know if you remember in the early 2000s, there were all these screenwriting gurus out there telling you there was only one way to write a script. And so one of the aims we had in writing that book is to show that there are as many ways to do it as there are writers. And so when you get this premise, you start from the same place and you see them go in, 27 different directions. It's kind of exciting. And the kids learned a lot of craft. You know, they learned about craft and about devices. And we have we interviewed a very famous screenwriter who was asked once, what's the difference between a trick and a device? And he said, a device is a trick that works. So that's what we wanted to show. I think the other thing, Peter would probably agree with this, is we got to see them as human beings, which was another nice part of it. And we got the history of Hollywood, which was kind of cool for me.
That's awesome.
Growing up around it. And so I think it's very proud of that book. And I owe Peter, you know, I did have the first and only time when I went to meet some parents of my children, friends of my children, where it worked out, because it's the only time it ever did. And now those kids are like, I don't even want to talk about how old those kids are. It's
you know, to sort of transition back into the business world, I'll tell you, I mentioned a study that we did where we gave a questionnaire to hundreds and hundreds of employees and asked them to rate their bosses on their sense of humor. And one thing that was interesting was the perception of somebody's humor correlates with wonderful traits. They all thought that their bosses were more creative if they had a good sense of humor, that they were brighter. But the thing that I found most interesting in the study was, we asked them, would you rate your boss as having a hostile or friendly sense of humor? And the ones who rated their bosses having a hostile sense of humor also found their bosses to be less approachable, which is sort of interesting because when you're an executive, you want people to come to you when there's something wrong, when there's a problem. If you know you've got some hostile guy that's going to make fun of you and belittle you, it's not very approachable. And so an interesting way to get more out of your employees, to get them closer to you, is more self-effacing humor and laughing at other things, but not knowing that they're going to make fun of your tie or your table manner.
Gotcha. I mean, that's a very interesting point. And I've seen it before in the past in my careers as well. Somebody that you feel that you can have a good sense of humor with, they're more approachable and you're more likely to bring things to their attention and talk to them and have a closer relationship.
But, you know, we found it particularly interesting that having a sense of humor important, but the kind of humor also makes a difference. I shouldn't mention the F word on the radio or on a podcast, but Freud did a lot of work on humor, and he made a point of saying, Most humor is based on hostility. And so it's kind of an interesting point to remember. But as much fun as it is to make fun of people, kind of can come back and bite you on the butt.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So Pitch Like Hollywood is coming out February 2022, is my understanding. What inspired you both to write this book? And then I guess how would you compare your experience writing this book compared to the other books that you've written?
Okay, so I'll go first on this one because it was Peter's idea. And I want to give him full credit for it because he said to me, well, actually, the book was an evolution. And now we're going to bring Darwin into it. We mentioned Freud, now we get Darwin. It really was a book that started out to be about the Hollywood pitch and Hollywood and for screenwriters. And then Peter said, full credit to Peter, he said, this book has implications for any business. And I said what I usually say when I'm when I'm faced with something I've never done before. Yeah, but I've never written this kind of book before. And he really mentored me as we went along. And the book, I want to say the book took about 3 years. And it's, I think the most exciting thing for me is to have interviewed these amazing people across professions who all said the same thing. I think this is the biggest thing I took away from it, is that a pitch is not to sell. A pitch is to start a conversation. And the minute you start selling, I mean, we've all had that experience of people talking at us and not really listening. So to have people from across professions say that was wonderful. And I think that's going to help people. And that's exciting. I'm very excited that people will, I hope, get from the exercises and from just a lot of the, footnotes do we have in this book, Peter? It's a lot of research that went into this book. I give Peter full credit for that. Go ahead. Sorry.
When we were first, this book is actually an outgrowth of the comedy book, where as we were interviewing these people, we also asked them questions instead of just making them work. And a lot of them had stories about pitching, which we found fascinating. And so we decided to start that project. And although Jeffrey gave me credit for seeing the wider applicability, the credit I'll take is for having read the Harvard Business Review, where there was a fantastic article that said, "We're going to do the largest scale research study ever done on pitching. And we're going to pick the hardest area in the world there is to pitch, Hollywood." And so I said, of course, yeah, this is the same principles. Why not extend them? It makes it a lot more interesting. And, I immediately dug into the research literature because, when in doubt, see what all the smart people are doing and copy from them. But Jeffrey said, we definitely should have the research literature. Science tells us a lot of stuff. Let's use it. But also, let's go out and he came up with an insistence that we go out and interview really successful people who are great at pitching and have some human stories about great things that happen, what they've discovered. And we find that a combination of the two really makes the book much more dynamic. And so we met some incredible people. And ironically, since we talk a lot about how to use story in pitching, we got incredible stories from some of these folks. Can I tell you one story just to give you an example?
Absolutely.
I'm going to take that as a yes. a good friend of ours was a producer and also a theatrical manager. He managed Robin Williams and Billy Crystal and very incredible people. And he came in and went to the head of New Line Cinema and said, got this great idea. I want to pitch it to you. And the head of New Line Cinema has a huge German Shepherd that he's got all sorts of doctor's notes that it's really a care dog and that he can take into restaurants. And so our friend is pitching. The dog is on the couch. The head of the company is behind the desk. And then he gets up and says, "I got to make a quick phone call." As he gets to the door, he says, "Keep pitching." So my friend turns to the writer that's with him and says, "We're supposed to pitch the dog?" And now they're looking around to see, is there a camera? Are we being punked? What's going on here? And then he said, "Well, what the heck? Let's pitch the dog." And so they continue their pitch. He comes in at the end to hear the ending, buys the thing. And it got made into a movie with a sequel. And one of the things he said jokingly was he didn't know, you know, whether it was the dog's reaction or just the fact that we were willing to pitch the dog that got it. But,
wow.
I fought very hard for about 3 months to make that the title of the book, but I lost the battle.
That would have been great.
I think to me, of all the stories in the book, and they were great stories, that's up in the top 10 stories of the book. But we thought better of it.
That's awesome. That's great. What other folks that you spoke to in your research, you know, can you talk about like different career paths of folks that you spoke to and a little bit more of the feedback that you got from people you were talking about that, that did pitches for a living?
You know, we talked to a venture capitalist who made my neck hurt because I kept going like this as he was talking, agreeing with him. And the very first thing is he echoed what Jeffrey said at the beginning about make it a conversation. He said, "I hate being talked at. I hate being sold." And also that it should definitely be two ways. He said, if somebody's telling me about their company and what they want and what they expect from me and what says, I don't see any room or reason for me to be there. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at what can I contribute? What can I put into the mix? How can I use my skills to help? I don't want to just write you a check. I want to be part of the operation.
Right.
And it's sort of an interesting thing that quite often, let me back up a step. We just wrote a little paper talking about every time that you pitch, there's the specific agenda you have that you're pitching, but there's also a hidden one, which you have to pay attention to, which is you're pitching your project, but you're pitching yourself. And what you're trying to demonstrate to the folks that you're talking to is, this is a person I'd like to work with. This is a person whose company I like and who I think does things well and will be a good partnership. And you know, we've all had people who, when we make a helpful suggestion, we're met with hostility and defensiveness. And it just tells people, get as far away from this person as you can possibly get.
Mm-hmm.
And in the book, we actually address techniques for if somebody is not making suggestions, how you can elicit them. Because again, it's really important when somebody makes a suggestion, even if you don't like it, what they're saying to you is, we'd like to forge a creative collaboration with you. That's what you want. That's your right. Road to a green light.
Right, they're engaged.
Right.
And that they want to be part of it.
Right.
And anything you do to discourage that, you might as well just open a vein.
Yeah, it's interesting. And Peter brings that up because I'll go back to my youth, my ugly youth. After my partnership broke up, we were talking about this yesterday, Peter and I. I was on my own for a while, and the breakup of that first partnership was hard. And I would go to meetings, and I would just be, I would challenge everything. I was a kid, and I would challenge everything, and I would be, someone gave me a suggestion, I wouldn't be very nice about it. And I think you learn, you don't get very far that way. And you learn that it's really not, and I think young people generally speaking are very precious about their own work, no matter what the field. So you learn that it's a lot more fun to collaborate. And I hope that's one of the thing Peter's talking about. I hope that's one of the points that people take away from this book, that nobody does anything alone. Things almost always get better when you work with someone else on them. And I think that's going to be a fun thing for people to read about and adapt in their own lives.
One of the funny ironies that people talked about when they broached the subject was quite often the people that are making these suggestions later down the road don't even remember they made them. And so the idea of fighting something to get really, really poor rapport with somebody just for not doing something that they're not going to do anyway is kind of ironic.
Peter's also reminding me, Joseph, of the fact that the other thing we've talked a lot about, and we talk a lot about in the book, is it isn't just about the meeting you're at or the product or service you're trying to sell at that moment. Because if they like you and you are someone who appears collaborative, the odds are they're going to ask you back. If you're a jerk and you don't know how to listen, we've got some great examples of the book about people who didn't know how to listen. One guy coming in, what's that great story about? Tell the story about Boeing, and isn't it Boeing where the guy comes in flip-flops? And I think you should tell that story, Peter.
Literally, a guy came in shorts, in a Hawaiian shirt and flip-flops with an attaché case that he never opened during the interview. Actually, that was the Toyota one.
Toyota, correct.
Yes. And he's telling these top Toyota scientists that he's got some breakthroughs in how to make better gas mileage. And we were interviewing a guy who was the head of Toyota America. And he's saying, we're spending $3 billion a year on doing research. And this kid is telling us, no, forget that. I got the answer. Of course, I'm not opening my case to tell
he
you.
He never did, right? He never opened the case.
And it's amazing. But we also had a really nice story. We got to interview the executive vice president and chief technical officer at Boeing, the number two guy at Boeing, who, you know, one of the things we always said was that when we were doing these interviews, tell us about the best and worst pitches that you saw. Mm-hmm. He talked about a woman who knew the top people at Boeing, so she got the interview, and she was an attorney, and said she was so good, so empathic, that she wanted Boeing to be involved in a project where they were going to give prize to the first person that made a self-flying machine. And they said, you know, this is great because Boeing will lend its name and its, you know, technology expertise to this, which will give it a lot of impact. And this fellow is thinking to himself, this is great until the first person dies. Boeing doesn't need.
Right.
And said, down the road, she's saying, now look, I can see down the road there may be some difficult issues. So what we'd like is Boeing to be coming in at the initial phase, the development phase, and then we'll let you guys leave when we take over the actual implementation. So there's no chance that if there are any problems, Boeing will be associated. He said, that was so smart. The way she said, she went in there and pitched saying, here's what you're going to get out of it. Here are your benefits, rather than here's what I want and here's what you should do for me.
And great approach.
And she figured out where her vulnerabilities are and already had them covered before Boeing could bring them up. She'd already handled it, saying, I'm thinking of you guys too. We want to make sure you guys are safe in the process.
That's great. You know, and you guys also cover some items that don't work in pitches. And I thought that was interesting to read about. And you know, you covered at one point, you discussed how there's things you can say and techniques that you can approach when giving a pitch that are immediately going to just turn off the people that are listening to your pitch and just already have their mind made up, you said something like, we'll come up with like a contrarian view or argument to what you're saying. Can you kind of touch on that topic as well?
Well, you can already see we're experts on alienating people. You can tell from this short interview. One of the things that Jeffrey and I talked a lot about in the book is how essential it is to do your research. And by research, meaning look for what the company or the people that you're pitching to have done, where their successes have been, and not just not even just make a list of their successes, but the successes that they're proud of. Mm-hmm. We've heard some great stories where somebody went in and complimented people on a project that they hated, even though they made money and were successful with it. They were not proud of the project, and they absolutely slit their own throats by saying, "Oh, and this thing was a wonderful thing."
Yeah. One of my I'm sorry, Peter. Go ahead.
Just there's something that's also really interesting. Are you familiar with a fellow named Daniel Kahneman?
I'm not.
He wrote a book called Thinking Fast and Slow that every sentient being should read. It's the smartest book I've read in the last 30 years. And one of the things that he talks about is most of the decisions that you make, there's two ways to make a decision. You can use really deep, hard thinking or your intuition. And everybody uses their intuition. And they really resist having to do hard thinking. And when you ask them what they use, they'll all say, "Oh, we're using deep, hard thinking," when he does experiments to show they're absolutely not. And one of the things that he pointed out is that, now, we're using intuition like it's sort of a wishy-washy, flim-flam thing. No. Your intuition is based on everything you know, every belief you have, every bias you have, basically everything that makes it easy to get through a day. And the minute you cross that and say something that is not intuitive to somebody and force them into deep thinking, not only are they grumpy because they're having to work hard now, but it sends up a red flag that kind of says, be wary here, be skeptical. This isn't what you normally would think. And it puts people in a situation that makes them harder to persuade.
Right.
Right.
So, that's a really good point. And you're right. People are just going to react with, you know, I don't know how to kind of receive this, and it's not intuitive, and it kind of puts you off.
In the persuasion literature, there's a phenomenon called social proof, which basically says follow the group; they generally know what's the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. In one of the great experiments, they had a guy standing on a busy urban street corner like this, looking up in the air, and people just walking right by him. Then, second condition, four people are standing together doing this, and everybody stops to look up. And it's sort of follow the group, it's safer.
Right. So, and they're probably not looking at anything. Everyone's just kind of looking up.
But it's the right thing to do, because otherwise, why is everybody doing it? Mm-hmm. And so if you've done your background research on the person or people or company that you're pitching, and you already know these are the things we like, these are our mottos, these are our viewpoints, these are our goals, and you pitch consonant with those, you've got a much easier chance of making your pitch work than if you cut it and contrast it at every turn.
Right. You know, I think the way the Hollywood pitch came in to this book and became the title is kind of part of this, is people come into meetings, even in Hollywood. And one of the great stories in the book is a producer told us that someone came into a meeting and said, they said, "Well, what do you have for us today?" And he said, I guess it was a team. They said, "Basketball Wives." And he said, "Yeah." And they said, "No, that's it. Basketball Wives." So one of the things that we point out in the book is that you have to have a story. Lots of times people have PowerPoint presentations and graphs and all of these things. And I think that can be like a, you know, act like a, like an Ambien, you know, just put people out. And so we talk about how you construct a story to go with the product or service, how you have a beginning, a middle, and a sense of how you're going to solve the person's problem.
You know, that's right. I mean, people want to hear stories. People, people don't want to hear like stories. Boring statistics and yeah. things like that. They want to hear right. an everyday life kind of situation, how it's going to affect them.
Absolutely. And again, in the cognitive science literature, there's abundant data that says people remember stories better. They listen to them more easily. And so again, you know, the title of my book, obviously, The Hollywood Pitch, is when you're giving your pitch, the more you can base it on story, the more they'll take it in, remember important details. We cite an interaction I had with somebody I work with who, you know, young Stanford grad was on the fast track in investment banking. And he came in saying, I get terrified because every week I have to give a talk in front of the board where they give me data to research a company. And I have to say, should we invest in this or not? And I'm looking at just a bunch of glazed over eyes as I'm spouting one stat after another. And so what we said was, all right, let's make this a three-act structure. And so we gave the background as act one, so they had a sense of what was going on. And then we said, let's look at every bit of data that puts us at all into conflict and get their interest in the second act. And then we use the third act to resolve it, to say, here's what it means. And this guy came back so happy because he said, the first thing I noticed was people listened to my presentations. And the next thing was I used like half the numbers I used to use because I said, if the numbers I'm using don't deal with the narrative that I'm talking about, they're irrelevant. So now every number I'm using is part of the story. And so it makes the numbers become important and interesting. And he said, the biggest compliment I got was all the other people in my position started using the same format.
Wow. That's awesome. And I know you also talked about in the book, kind of related to that, is the anatomy of the pitch and the different kind of aspects of that. Can you kind of touch briefly on that?
Sure. You're talking about the three-act structure and every story has a beginning, middle, and an end. What we do in the book is we use Neil Simon's The Odd Couple, the greatest comedy written in the 20th century by an American anyway. And it's weird to say 20th century now. We use that because it demonstrates rising action, falling action. It demonstrates how you would put, we ask people to adapt their pitch to that model. And the first act is always the setup. The most of the conflict is in the second act, and then the resolution is the third act. And we have found that it works. Peter wrote a wonderful piece in the book modeled on the Neil Simon play, which is about a food app. And people should really read the book because it's complex, but it's adaptable. And the thing that's great is there needs to be some conflict to keep people interested.
When Jeffrey and I were first writing the book about comedy writers, you know, as good scientists, we made a prediction and we said, well, what do you think? Are these writers going to talk more about story or character? And surprisingly, the answer was neither. Conflict. All comedy is based on conflict, as is all story. And so to keep people interested, you've got to have some conflict
right.
in the story. Now, let me go back and just predate what Jeffrey said. The first part that you do in a pitch is you look for some kind of hook, something that in a sentence or two immediately gives you the overarching picture. Because again, people do better when they are presented with information top down and they get the big picture first so they know where everything fits. And then right. a log line. Something that, Jeffrey, if you want to give them the hook and log line for The Odd Couple, it's a great example.
Oh, sure. Actually, I love Peter's. It's the hook would be something along the lines of saving. It's gone out of my head now. It's been so long, but What is the hook? You know, you created it. So what is it? It's not his real hook. We invented what we thought might be it.
We made
it's like saving your
Neil Simon's pitch for him.
So it, I think it's something like saving your best friend's life could kill you.
And
it gives you
And the log line was something like the world's neatest person and the world's sloppiest person both get thrown out by their wives, move in together to recreate the same terrible situations. And so already everything else you're going to say is now falling into place.
Right.
So again, if you can give somebody in the beginning of your pitch something there. Now, something interesting is we're finding out that the research on decision-making shows that most of it, you know, first impressions are gargantuan and they kind of stay with you for a really long time. And the situation we're finding is the beginning of your pitch is by far the most important part because it sets the tone for everything else. We talked to a friend of ours who's not only a wonderful writer, but does an incredible job pitching. He's famous for it. He's just working on a movie now with LeBron James. It's incredible. And he was saying, if I'm pitching somebody, I don't start with Joe woke up in the morning, looked in the mirror, brushed his teeth, shaved, then slowly put on his clothes and walked outside. He said, my beginning is Joe walked outside and saw the meteor plummeting toward his house.
Right.
And he says, get somebody in there right away, because he said, you've got 3 or 4 minutes to really determine the course of what's going to happen. If right. you haven't gotten their interest by then, it doesn't look good.
All right. I mean, you know, what's great about this is that this strategy can work for basically any type of pitch situation,
right? Absolutely. It's essential for any kind of pitch. Absolutely. And let me mention just one other point here that I think is important for people who are pitching to do. One of the things that you should be doing in your preparation is identifying all your weak points. And you need to present them before they're presented unto you. It's interesting that there's some research that says in advertising, if you show one or two bad points after you've talked about all the great points, you actually invoke trust from people. There's a name for it. It's called the blemishing effect.
I've heard that before.
Mm-hmm. And it's kind of interesting. When I was a young boy in graduate school, I had a research psychologist as my boss, and I could never win an argument with him, which frustrated me to no end. And by the way, he was from El Paso, a neighbor of yours.
Nice.
And what I started, when I got a little more analytic, what I noticed was what he always did to me, which is I would give him my best argument, the one that he couldn't refute because it's the winning argument. And then he would paraphrase my argument, weakening it, and then argue to his paraphrase instead of my argument, which is really brilliant. And what we tell people to do is if you know that there's something that people are going to balk at, seize control over that item and present it in the best way that you can, rather than waiting for somebody to put it in the worst possible terms so that you're mitigating the effects of it. And you're also demonstrating your integrity. So it's a twofer. And present it in such a way that it's easy for them to deal with. And you don't want them sitting there thinking about, any minute now I get to ask the question and I'm going to say, what about this?
Right. Right. It builds trust and also shows you're thinking about all angles and you got it all covered.
Right. And again, it goes back to, you know, the thing I told you about before, Boeing, that it kind of makes you an empath, that I'm thinking about you as well as me. I want you to be as satisfied with this arrangement as I hope to be.
Absolutely. What would you guys say? Was there anything that really surprised you in the process of writing this book and doing the research and just putting it together? Anything that stood out that kind of just you didn't see coming or really surprised you?
Oh, lots of things. For me, I mean, I am not trained as a researcher. A lot of things. I'll tell you one thing that I sort of knew intuitively, you know, since we're talking about intuitive people and using your intuition. I knew this and I'd seen it in the business, but I think one of the things we talk about in the book, we interviewed a wonderful producer who is a former student of mine, and she's now got Rob Reiner's nephew as her partner, and they're partnering with Jerry Seinfeld on some things. And she told, I'm not going to tell you the story because it's a long story, but she had a deal set up at a major studio. And the studio did what studios often do, is the story had nothing to do with I'll just give you briefly the overview. It's about a woman with a heart condition who's never really had the romance that she wanted in her life. And she goes to a wedding and she's supposed to give the toast. She's the bride and best friend. And the studio came in and said, we want her to sleep with the bridegroom the night before the wedding. And she said, that's got nothing to do with the story. And she turned the deal down, and it was a major studio. And she was really afraid that the writer was going to be angry. And the writer said, no, that's exactly what I would have done. So I think the lesson is, don't be afraid to walk away if it feels wrong, because it probably is. And right. I think a lot of people, myself included, I can speak to this because I've done it. You go into something, the red flags are all there, you don't pay attention to them, and it's heartbreaking. Right. So I think that's a really good lesson across businesses. If it feels wrong, I'm sure you've had that in your law practice.
Absolutely. What you feel in your gut sometimes is the way to go.
Let me piggyback on what Jeffrey's saying here. A number of people have said, it's great to be flexible and bend when they make suggestions. But if they start going after your core and you start to bend, then it makes it look like you have no passion, no commitment. What do you stand for, if anything? And you will wreck your pitch. So it's a fine line, and it's definitely bend but don't break. So it's something to listen to. You know, as far as surprises, if you have another 2 or 3 hours, because I spent so much time in the research literature, we're constantly surprised at the results that we see. And they're fascinating things. I'll just give you one quick example. In the stage fright literature, one of the things we know is that one of the biggest enemies is distraction. And whether it's something that happens out there or something between the ears, if you start making a dire prediction, I think I'm going to forget what's coming up, or he looks like he's really bored and yawning or whatever, you can really throw yourself off totally. And so they did a study where they took meditators and non-meditators, stuck them in an fMRI machine so they could do brain scans. Mm-hmm. And then they gave them a task where they had them do some innocuous thing, and then they interrupted them and then measured how long does it take till they get back on track. And the meditators whooped the non-meditators.
Wow.
Okay, interesting. 3 years meditation. Okay, you got to get something. So they said they did another similar study with 3 month meditators. That was enough. They got the same results. Okay. But 3 months is still a long time. You know, I got a pitch coming up in a week and a half. That's hard to cram in that 3.5 months of meditation. Then they did a study where they gave students 10 minutes of meditation training. And that was enough to teach them how to get back when they're distracted. Pretty amazing.
Wow. That's interesting.
And we worry, because if you don't have 10 minutes to prepare, you're probably not built for meditation.
Right. That's a good point. Is there any other thing that you both would like to highlight about the book for listeners? Anything that we didn't cover?
Well, we think McGraw-Hill made a beautiful cover.
Yes, they did.
With it.
I would just say that
Oh, thank you.
Oh, wow. Great cover. Thank you.
Or you rubbing it in that we don't have it and you do.
I would just say that having probably read most books on pitching, I love the way that the book, the last part of the book, really is the preparation. And then it's like, how do you enter the room?
Right.
So you're getting, so the book really builds and it has this nice last third that, you know, like all third acts has a nice resolution where I believe we really worked hard to prepare anybody. The thing I guess I'd like to say, Joseph, is that a lot of people over the years have told us, oh, if you can't pitch, stay home. One Academy Award winning producer told us that. And then what did the person say 5 minutes later? Something contradicted or something. But I hope this book proves that really it's an art as much as it is a science, and that anyone can do it. It's not for the rare few, people. And I think that's great. I think that might be something that other books don't talk about, because a lot of books are do this, this, and this, the what I'm telling you. I have the answer. And I think what we've proven, as we did in our previous book, is there is no one right answer.
Right. I think it is truly universal, and these concepts apply to kind of really any type of pitch situation, in my opinion.
Well, we sort of joked with our publisher that we wanted the title to be, you know, there are all these books like The Seven Habits of, you know, Great People and stuff. And I kind of blanch at that, think if it's that easy, why isn't everybody highly effective? And so we wanted to call it the 837 rules of pitching. Because there's lots and lots and lots of little things that all accrue and add up to all these things. But we think they all make sense. And we feel good about the fact that they've been proven in the field, which is why we're so happy to have interviewed these powerful people. But we also have the empirical validation that they actually work. People that wear long white lab coats actually said they're true too. So we sort of covered the landscape that way. And again, you know, that Jeffrey's really right. We try to look at both the art and science of pitching.
Absolutely. And so listeners, where can listeners find the book online, and where can people buy the book?
Well, of course, Amazon is the easy go-to place. Barnes & Noble will have it. I mean, all your major booksellers. McGraw-Hill is a wonderful publisher. They get the book out pretty well. And it's not a hard thing to find. And we're pretty excited at this point because we work really hard.
Sounds good. And for listeners that want to learn more about both of you and learn more about the books, the other books that you've written, where can they go online?
We have a website, and I believe it's desbergandavis.com. So it should be pretty easy to find. And we have our contact info if somebody wants to email us. We love responding to people. It's, you know, we're here to try and make stuff better. And we're easy.
Excellent.
Best place to get a hold of me is around the ankle.
Love it. Love it. I'm gonna put the information on the link to the Amazon page for the book where you can buy it, listeners can buy it, and then I'll put a link to your website in the show notes so folks can learn more about you. I'm reading the book. I'm really enjoying it. I'm going to use the lessons I've learned from this book in my career as an attorney and different things I'm involved in. And Peter and Jeffrey, I really appreciate your time and
for having us.
One quick statement. This has been one of the easiest, nicest interviews I can remember. You are really good at your craft, sir.
Yes, you are.
You made us
thank you so much.
Comfortable and welcome. And, you know, you even laughed at a couple of jokes. I mean, you can't ask.
Yeah, me. Peter likes that. You need to laugh at his jokes.
That's my criterion for if somebody's nice.
I love it. I really appreciate it. And hey, you guys are awesome to have on the program. I want to encourage listeners to go out and buy the book, but I'd love to have you gentlemen on the podcast again sometime.
We'd be delighted.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
This episode is brought to you by our affiliate, Gemini. Gemini is a well-respected cryptocurrency exchange started by Cameron and Tyler Winklevoss. If you're interested in purchasing Bitcoin, Ethereum, or other altcoins, please check out their website at gemini.sjv.io/moontower to learn all about it. Thank you.